Please turn your Bibles to Daniel and chapter 11. Daniel and chapter 11. And this evening we'll be considering verses 21 through to 35. Daniel 11, verse 21 through to 35. Let me read from 20. There shall arise in his place one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle. And in his place shall arise a vile person to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. With the force of a flood, they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. And after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. He shall enter peaceably even into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. Yes, those who eat of the portions of his delicacies shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. Both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table, but it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. While returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the holy covenant, so he shall do damage and return to his own land. At the appointed time, he shall return and go down the south, down toward the south. But it shall not be like the former or the latter. For ships from Cyprus shall come against him. Therefore, he shall be grieved and return in rage against the holy covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the holy covenant. And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many. Yet for many days they shall fall by the sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue. And some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them, purify them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. So far in our reading. This evening we will continue in our reflection on Daniel chapter 11, which, as you will have noted last week, is, along with chapter 12, a very selective prophetic overview of the flow of history from the time of Daniel in the late 6th century BC until the end of the world, until the final climactic conflict and victory of God. Last week, we only had time to consider a small portion of that history, and there is a chance that you probably found the account of the history a bit boring, a dizzying and confusing array of military alliances and marriage alliances, and if you lost interest in trying to follow all of that, it is very understandable. Most people don't particularly find reading and hearing history interesting. I grew up like that. I was given to loving mathematics and science. I didn't really have much time for history and anything that came under the arts. But over time, and especially since becoming a pastor, I have grown to love it and also to appreciate its place and importance in our lives as individuals and as Christians in particular. My hope is therefore that you will find it interesting, and I'll try my best to make it clear and simple. I will not care to go into all the details of the history being recounted here. I don't think it's necessary, but if we keep to the main ideas, we will still get the gist of what is being communicated here. Well, what did we consider the last time? We reminded ourselves of the fact that Daniel chapter 11 was God's response to Daniel's praying, moaning, and fasting over the Israelites' experience in Jerusalem, to which they had returned after their time in exile in Babylon, and where they were now settled and rebuilding the temple and re-establishing their life in that promised land. But where, unfortunately, they were now faced with great opposition from their enemies all around. The rebuilding work had swiftly ground to a halt, and people had subsided into a maintenance lifestyle focused on bare survival. The glorious optimism that was present immediately after Cyrus issued his decree that they could go back to their land, that optimism had faded into a general attitude of discouragement and despair. And as Daniel learns of that, he was disturbed, began to pray, to moan, to fast. And God heard the prayer. The response Daniel received is recounted in chapter 10 and, of course, chapter 11 as well as 12. Chapter 11 consists in a prophetic overview of the history, certainly from Daniel's time. And the particular history we considered last week related to the remaining history of Persia, who were still controlling Israel at the time, and also the history of Greece that would succeed the Persians not very long from the time of the Persians. And the history of these nations recounted in verse 5 through to 20, that is to say, the history of the Persians and of the Greeks, basically is a history of conflict. It's a history of war. Their last great king was Alexander the Great. He's the one who had conquered the Persians. He was a great man, very gifted man. But he didn't rule for a long time because he died. And when he died, his empire split into four. There was fighting for control among his generals. And two of those generals emerged as the most prominent among them. There was a general called Seleucus, based in Syria, and another one called Ptolemy, based in Egypt. They were the strongest, and they were basically trying to outwit each other in order to establish total control over everyone else. But they were never able to outwit each other. Sometimes the Seleucids, that is the general in Syria, won. At other times, the Ptolemies won, and it kept going in that way. So we saw that it's a history on conflict. In this sermon, we want to continue in our consideration of that history as we continue to reflect on Daniel 11. And we will pick up the studies from verse 21, which takes us to a figure who dominates most of this chapter. The first half of the chapter covers the reign of seven Seleucid kings. Seleucid from Seleucus. Seleucus was the general who began to rule there, and many other Seleucids succeeded him. And eventually we come to this figure who was very dominating. He is not named in this chapter, but history identifies him as Antiochus the Fourth. He called himself Antiochus Epiphanes. He succeeded to the throne of the Seleucids when his brother, Seleucid the Fourth, died. And he became a very important figure in the history related to Israel. He reigned from 175 BC to about 164 BC. Originally, he was named Mithridates, but he gave himself the name Antiochus Epiphanes, which meant God manifest. Can you imagine? He named his capital city Antioch. There were two Antiochs. There was an Antioch in Syria that was named after Epiphanes, and there was an Antioch in Pisidia. He was referred to in Daniel chapter 8. Of course, we have already come across him. And there, he features as the little horn. The little horn who would persecute Israel and set up the first abomination of desolation in the temple at Jerusalem. His wicked actions are also prefigured, or rather they prefigure the experience of the people of God right at the end of time. And this takes us right to the end of the book of Revelation, which speaks about Satan's little season, when Satan would be released for a short time to persecute the people of God. What Antiochus did toward the end of the Old Testament prefigures that which will happen toward the end of the New Testament. So there are a number of points highlighted in Daniel 11 on Antiochus the Fourth, which I wish to draw your attention to. Four in particular. And the first thing we learn about him is that he would be a vile or despicable person. This is how he is described in verse 21. In his place, that is to say, in the place of Seleucus the Fourth, who had just died through an assassination, shall arise a vile person. What a way of being described. Many people want to be remembered for good things, for things that help others, for characters that are exalted. But Antiochus Epiphanes was referred to as a vile person. Some versions use the word despicable, a despicable person. And that simply means he was someone worthless, someone who was regarded, especially by the Jews, by the Israelites, with great contempt because of what we will go on to see about him. So he would be a vile or despicable person. Secondly, he would seize the kingdom by intrigue or through intrigue. We read once again in verse 21 through to 24, and in his place shall arise a vile person to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. With the force of a flood, they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. And after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come upon and become strong with a small number of people. He shall enter peaceably, even into the richest places of the province. And he shall do what his fathers had not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. Now, Antiochus Epiphanes was not the heir to the throne. He did not deserve to be given the honor of royalty. That is why it is said here, to whom they will not give the honor of royalty. And although he was not next in line after the death of his brother, rather, Seleucus' son, a man by the name of Demetrius, was the real heir. But Antiochus Epiphanes took the throne. It would appear that Demetrius was probably too young to take the responsibility, and Antiochus stood in his place as a regent in the hope that at some point when he is able to take the reins, he would hand over to him and let him rule. But Antiochus did not give up the throne. He gained it through intrigue. He gained it through secret scheming. He literally invaded the kingdom when its people felt secure. He seized it. He actually had his army ready to carry out his commands, and an overwhelming army it was. It swept away before him. It gained control now by force, and he was firmly in place. Demetrius, this is probably who is being referred to as the Prince of the Covenant. In other words, there was this understanding that he would become the ruler, but he didn't, because he was also killed. He was also destroyed in the process, so that Antiochus can confirm himself in the position. So initially, with only a few people, he rose to power. Over time, he had built a great army that could not be resisted by anyone in his realm. He didn't just use a bit of force and fear. He also used corruption. He bribed. He gave plunder, spoil, and riches to the people so they would like him. Very similar to what many politicians do in this country and elsewhere. He would defeat smaller nations and distribute the spoil from his wars, and the people would like him. In verse 24, we read, "He shall enter peaceably even into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers had not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, the spoil, the riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time." So through both a bit of force, a bit of deception, through a bit of bribery, bribing the people as it were, he was able to confirm himself in that position. The third thing we note is that he devised his plans against what my version refers to as strongholds. You find that word used in verse 24, and you find it elsewhere in this chapter. Strongholds. These strongholds were other countries, other provinces. They were ruled by kings. They were ruled by other leaders, perhaps less than kings. And he devised his plans against them. And of course, the plan was to outwit them and overtake them. We, for example, read about his plan against the south, that is to say, against Egypt. Egypt was the biggest among these kingdoms. And to overcome Egypt was to increase his own power and influence. So just like his predecessors, he also wanted to overpower Egypt and bring it under its control. So if you like, he revived the hostilities between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, the kings of the north, the kings of the south. And when he launched out to the south, the king who ruled there was a man called Ptolemy the Sixth. There had been other Ptolemies, of course. This was the sixth one, and he initiated hostilities against him. We read about that in verse 25. He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. But he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. So he went to the south. The south was ready for him. And Antiochus won that battle. Perhaps he didn't win it in a big enough way for him to have complete control over the south. They had some control, some influence, but only some. A few years later, Antiochus wanted to go back, basically to try and finish them off. So he invaded Egypt again, but this time with disastrous results. In other words, he didn't win that battle. And the reason he didn't win that battle was that he got some help from the Romans. The Romans at the time were a rising power. They would soon take over the whole empire, but at this point, they were still a developing power. And as Antiochus made his way to Egypt, the Egyptians had invited the Romans to help them. And so they came. Under the leadership of a general called Gaius Popilius Lianus, they met Antiochus as he approached Alexandria. General Gaius drew a circle in the sand around Antiochus, insisting that he withdraws, and that before he leaves that circle, he must indicate exactly what his plan was. If he wanted to progress toward Alexandria, he must say. And of course, they would rout him. They would kill him and his forces. But if he wanted to go back to Syria, they would let him go. But he won't leave the circle until he has declared what his plans were. Well, Antiochus was wise at that point. He decided he didn't want to die, didn't want to be overcome, so humiliated, he was forced to withdraw. And that is how he went back. The first thing we need to note about Antiochus is that he was resisted by the people of God, and his heart was moved against what is known as the Holy Covenant here. Now, remember that Egypt was in the south, Syria was in the north, Israel was sandwiched between these two nations. And when these two big kingdoms fought, sometimes they fought their battle on Israeli territory. The Israelites at this moment were effectively under the control of the Syrians, the Seleucids. They were under the control of Antiochus. So when Antiochus was launching his war in Egypt, rumors had circulated in Judah, in Israel, that he had been assassinated. Now, that was not true, but that was the rumor that was circulating. And given the fact that Antiochus was dead, many Jews felt that this was their moment to free themselves from the rule of the Greeks. So there was an uprising by the Jews. And these people in history who led the uprising are called the Maccabees. And this revolt, this uprising, was known as the Maccabean revolt. So they rose against the Greeks, they rose against Antiochus, and hence the 32nd verse, which is very well known to us. It says, those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. The people who knew their God seized the opportunity. They resisted the Greeks. They protested. They revolted. And on his return, that is to say, Antiochus, singing from his humiliation at the hands of the Romans, and further enraged by the rebellion in Jerusalem, Antiochus stormed Jerusalem. Those who resisted him did it at great cost. He drafted in a general called Apollonius, the leader of a group of mercenaries. When they arrived in Jerusalem, he pretended to be peacefully disposed to the Jews. But on the Sabbath, he paraded his full army, a great army, very well armed, and he proceeded to massacre those Jews who resisted him. He massacred men and women and children and sold an additional 4,000 people into slavery. He basically ravaged the city mercilessly. In verse 33, we read, and those of the people who understand shall instruct many. Yet for many days they shall fall by the sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. And this was at the hand of Antiochus. You can understand why he was seen as a vile person. In addition to that, no effort was spared to destroy the faith of the people of God. He banned the Hebrew religion. He abolished the regular daily offerings or sacrifices at the temple. He set up a new altar, and he put up an image of Zeus. Now, this is in the temple of God. The house of God. In the house of God, he pulled down God's altar, and he put up an altar with an image of Zeus. And he was calling everyone not to worship their God, but to worship Zeus, the Greek god. And it is this image in God's temple that the Jews refer to as the abomination of desolation. And in this temple, it has now been corrupted, as it were. Pagan rites were celebrated. They were no longer bringing the animals that God had prescribed and commanded. Antiochus decreed that they are going to burn pig's flesh. And if you know anything about Judaism and pigs, you will know that they regarded them as dirty animals. And it is the flesh of these animals that would be offered on that altar. And he marshaled his forces to torture anyone who kept the Sabbath, anyone who honored the Hebrew scriptures. But in addition to this, he also corrupted the people with flattery. He was good at pleasing people. And he didn't just want to destroy the Jews. He wanted to gain the support of some of the Jews. And so he corrupted them with flattery. We read about these in verse 32, the early part of verse 32. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. And through that kind of force and flattery and deception, some of the Jewish people caved under the pressure and apostatized. They began to collaborate with Antiochus's forces. They began to be seduced and pressured into abandoning their covenant with God. And they were being moved to enter into a covenant with him. So some fell. But there were others who remained standing. Many who remained faithful in the face of the persecution. And they didn't just remain faithful, they profited from the persecution. And it is these, of course, who are being referred to as the people who know their God. They shall be strong, and they shall carry out great exploits. And yes, some of them lost their lives for remaining faithful. But they didn't consider it a loss, because as we shall go on to see when we leap into chapter 12, they will go on to the new heaven and the new earth, even though they die. They will go on to meet their Lord, even though they die. And so they were not afraid. It's as if they were following the words of the Lord Jesus Christ in Matthew 10 and verse 28. Do not be afraid of those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather, be afraid of the one who can destroy both body and soul in hell. So they were not afraid. They remained strong. They were purified by their persecution. We read about that in verse 35, and some of those of understanding shall fall, to refine them, purify them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. Sometimes obedience to God will mean a lifetime of faithfulness in a hostile environment. You know that Daniel himself experienced this. I'm sure he did know some good times, some quiet times. But we have already read about times in which he was faced with very severe temptations and very difficult and trying times. And there are believers who all their life, they have to live with these trials. They have to face the danger sometimes of losing their lives. That is the portion God appoints for us sometimes. There's a fifth and final thing I want to say about Antiochus. He did bring judgment upon himself. He was vile. He hated the people of God. He destroyed the people of God. He persecuted the people of God. And God didn't look the other way, even as he did that. God visited him with punishment, actually with death, because he did try to go back to the south, to try and overcome the king of the south. And the Romans came in to help once again. And this time round, they didn't just resist him, they destroyed him, and they conquered the Grecian kingdom altogether and began to rule over that whole realm. They ruled over Egypt, they ruled over the whole of Palestine, and that is what set in motion the kingdom of Rome. We are going to pause there and pick it up the next time, but I want to bring out a few applications before we come to an end. First of all, why did Daniel need to hear about this history in his situation? He was concerned about his people in Jerusalem. God had delivered them from the Babylonians. They were back in their land. There was a lot of promise that they will continue to rebuild and to prosper and to experience to the full God's promises to them as his chosen people. But here they were now. They were not making progress. The building projects had been stalled. It was as if God had turned his back on them. So Daniel prays, and this history is what God reveals to him. How was this supposed to help Daniel? Well, the goal was to put the difficulties that the Jews were facing in perspective. And basically, what God was saying to him was that there was nothing unique about the trials and tribulations that the Jews were facing. There was nothing new about it. Their experience should therefore not surprise him. It should not surprise them. As a matter of fact, these difficulties will not end. The difficulties they are suffering were being perpetrated by the Persians. After the Persians, the Greeks will come. And the Greeks will make things worse, especially under the rule of Antiochus Epiphanes. Fortunately, he didn't rule for a long time. And so the persecution they suffered didn't last forever. But he's basically saying to him, things will get worse. That is the first thing. Secondly, Daniel 11 also wants to teach Daniel and the Jews to remain faithful in the midst of the worst of trials. Now, these trials will not go on forever. There will come a time when the kingdom of God will arrive. The Lord will be the ruler. And the people of God will enjoy respite forever. Such a time will come. But before it comes, the people of God must remain faithful. He gives them this picture of freedom and the rule of God in Christ. We'll get to that. And that's part of the history. That is where history will terminate. So he gives him this vision to give him hope. And the clear lesson for us is that history is what gives us hope. Sometimes we can look back at things that have happened and draw very positive lessons from that. And that encourages us. But in this instance, what is happening is that God is actually revealing what is to come. What is to come will include more difficulties. So prepare yourselves. Remain faithful. But it will also include deliverance. So be hopeful. Your faithfulness is not in vain. Your faithfulness will not be a loss. Paul uses this kind of argument in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 19. And he was talking about the resurrection there. And he was writing to a people who might have been doubting about whether they will live another life. Is it really well, is it really profitable? Is it really beneficial to continue leading the Christian life and to suffer, to go through difficulties? And Paul was saying, yes. Even when you die, it is still profitable. It's still beneficial because there is another life we will live. There is a resurrection to be involved, to be experienced. In 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 19, it says, if it is only for this life that we have hope, then we are of all men most to be pitied. It's not only for this life that we have hope. We have hope for another life. We have hope for a resurrection. Paul, again, is speaking about what is to come. He is revealing what remains of history and how it will end. And it's all intended to give hope. That's exactly what Daniel is doing, what the Lord is doing in revealing this history to Daniel, to give him hope, to encourage the people of God to remain steadfast, to remain faithful. Well, brothers and sisters, through Daniel, God has also given us this history. And a lot of the history here has already played itself out. And we are able to interpret the details of this chapter because we live on this side of history. The things Daniel describes have already happened. So we can look at what happened and then work backwards to try and understand what Daniel was saying. So we already have some of that history lived out. But there is a history here that still lies in the future. There is a history here that we are presently living out. And there is a history here that will eventually terminate into the second coming of Christ, in which he will destroy all the enemies of God. He will judge them and throw them into hell. And then he will establish his kingdom, a new heaven and a new earth. We are still living out that history. We are still hoping for that consummation of history. And why do we have this information? Why do we have the book of Revelation? Because it is doing the exact same thing. It was written to people, Christians, who were suffering, who were finding life this side of eternity hard going, who were being persecuted for their faith. How does the Lord comfort them? Well, he gives them a vision of the purposes of God, a vision of what has happened to souls that have already died and where they have gone to. A vision of what the calamities of this world achieve for the people of God. And a vision of the triumph of God and of the Lamb. A vision of the new heaven and the new earth. A vision of the new Eden. Why does he reveal these things? It's to encourage us to remain faithful, to remain steadfast in our walk. It is to give us hope, even as we serve the Lord. So history has a purpose to serve. That's why we must read it. That's why we mustn't find it boring. That's why we must try and understand it. That is why we must draw lessons and principles for it, to better our lives, to strengthen our faith. For Jesus' sake, amen.